This week on Making Contact.
There have been jobs that I couldn't take because the bus simply wouldn't be able to get me there in time to start.
For many, public transportation isn't a choice, it's a necessity.
It means liberation. It means unlimited access. It means equal opportunity. The most difficult aspect of being blind is lack of independence with traveling.
When city budgets are cut, public transportation is often on the chopping block, and routes and lines serving those who need the service most can be the first to go. But an emerging transportation justice movement is standing up for people's right to ride.
When I say free, you say muni. Free?
Muni.
Free?
On this edition, from New York to Argentina, people organizing in the name of transportation for all. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Did we win this fight?
Yeah!
Was it a long fight?
Yeah!
Was it a hard fight?
Yeah!
Are you proud of winning this fight?
It's a school day, but hundreds of kids are out on the streets of San Francisco's Mission District celebrating. This week marks the beginning of a free Muni Youth Pass program, in which low and moderate income students can ride public transit for free 24 hours a day. The campaign for free Muni took 2 years, and it wasn't easy.
The civic engagement of youth in the Free Muni for Youth campaign has been something that we've barely ever even seen before.
17-year-old Nick Persky is a member of the San Francisco Youth Commission.
The number of youth coming into City Hall, flooding into City Hall, for various MTA meetings, various Board of Supervisors meetings, has been insane. We've never had this many youth come into City Hall before, and it's really something special to see.
Hundreds of high school students spent 2 years lobbying the Municipal Transportation Agency and Metropolitan Transportation Commission to lay out more than $6 million for the pilot program. Balboa High senior Paulo Acosta was one of them.
Just coming back over and over and over and over and over. The more networking and marketing we did about this campaign, we actually tired out the whole MTA and actually finally got to approve it.
But San Francisco's youth didn't do it alone.
Because you had the pressure from the grassroots up, we were able to make it happen.
John Avalos is a member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors.
It was an amazing inside-outside strategy. We knew that if it wasn't the people who were most impacted by the policies of Muni, who didn't raise their voices, that we wouldn't be able to make it happen on the inside.
Youth whose families make less than the Bay Area median income are eligible for the free pass. That's over 40,000 students. Not being able to afford the bus keeps some of those students from attending school or participating in after-school activities. Allowing kids to travel free also helps them explore different parts of the city and makes them more likely to become adults who use public transit. Getting more people onto buses, trains, and trolleys means fewer cars on San Francisco's busy streets and cleaner air for everyone.
We always believed that this effort was not just about satisfying the economic needs of these students, but it was really transforming how we as a city look at transportation.
City Supervisor David Campos helped lead the Free Muni for Youth campaign.
Other cities and other parts of the Bay Area are looking at this pilot as an example of what other cities can do for their families. We are talking about investing in the future generation of riders, and San Francisco is leading the way. We have done it. We have done it.
Spread the word, spread the truth.
Free Muni for all our youth.
Spread the word,
spread the truth.
Free Muni for all our youth.
In many ways, how we view public transportation reflects how we see our societies. Do we value shared resources or prefer private ownership? Will vital services be available to all, or just a few? Low-income youth, like those San Francisco school kids, are one example, but there are others who are even more dependent on public transport to go about their daily lives. We went to New York City, where reporter Britta Conroy Randall took a trip with blind advocate Romeo Amid to find out how easy it is for him to get around town.
The New York City subway system has 468 stations. It's the largest of any city in the world. There's 21 lines running 24 hours a day on 330 miles of track. So, there are times when even sighted people get confused. But Romeo Ameed, who's been blind since he was 2 years old, knows his way around pretty well.
You go up those stairs in the back, you go through the turnstile. When you go to the turnstile, you make a right. You go up the first set of stairs, then you make a left, go up another set, then you're on the street.
Like most other New Yorkers, Romeo uses subways and buses to get to work, visit family, and meet up with friends. He also walks a lot. He says he relies heavily on his other senses to make his way around safely.
Once the train pulls away, I stop for a second and start listening for sounds. When I'm listening for, like, turnstiles, MetroCard machines, I'm listening for traffic. If it's the winter time, I'm feeling too, not with my hands, but I'm paying attention to what I feel. Why? Because wherever the cold air is coming from will also be an indication of where the exit of the subway is.
In a city where around 7 million people use mass transit every day, you can't go far without hearing a complaint. Regular service interruptions, inconsistent schedules, ongoing renovations. But these things don't bother Romeo too much.
What I would say to that is, welcome to New York, you know?
To him, public transport means a lot more than just getting from point A to point B.
It means liberation. It means unlimited access. It means equal opportunity. The most difficult aspect of being blind is lack of independence with traveling. You know, if you're somebody that has to rely on rides, you're not at liberty as much as somebody who could just jump on a train or a bus at any moment and go do what they want to do.
The American Foundation for the Blind named New York as one of the country's most livable, chosen partly for its public transit system that, quote, allows blind residents to take full advantage of local, cultural, and social opportunities. But despite the city's high rating on issues of accessibility, there's a number of advocacy groups working on improving the city for blind residents, especially when it comes to transportation. Lester Marks, the Director of Government Affairs at Lighthouse International, says one of the major issues is accessible announcements.
The next stop is Beverly Road.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
He says they've been introduced into many subway lines over the past few years, but are still missing from buses.
You want to know what stop you're in. And you also maybe want to know the next stop that you're going to be arriving into, or, you know, how far along your stop is.
Romeo agrees. It's a problem he encounters every time he takes a bus.
Things can be tricky sometimes because, unlike a train, the bus doesn't always stop at the same stops every time you're on it. If somebody's not getting on or getting off at a particular stop, then it'll just pass by. So you can't count.
Romeo says audible announcements can help with route changes or detours too.
About 2 weeks ago, I was at a bus stop for an hour waiting for a bus. And turns out there was a sign there saying that the bus was detoured and you have to go a block down to catch the bus. And it was like 20 degrees that night, just froze, like unbelievable. And if I could see, that wouldn't happen.
There's a similar problem with hybrid and electric cars. Their almost silent engines pose a threat to blind people walking the city streets.
So obviously, if you're using your ears to cross streets and you're listening for where cars are and things, if you can't hear them, you know, they could run you over.
Romeo has worked alongside advocacy groups like Lighthouse and the National Federation of the Blind to lobby Washington, and they got a bill passed establishing minimum sound requirements for new hybrid and electric vehicles. Now they're hoping their lobbying efforts can affect a similar change on city buses. The MTA's annual performance review flags accessibility for the disabled as one of its key goals, but they don't mention accessible announcements. Lester Mark says people need to maintain the pressure if they want to see needed improvements.
If we as a blind community don't continually remind them or let them know about how, you know, somebody with a visual impairment or somebody who's blind travels, then of course they're not going to think about it as much.
Romeo says public transport has been a lifeline for him and many others in the blind community.
You see, you have to understand when you're talking to somebody like me, that just presents unlimited freedom. Some people are mentally free, but they're not physically free. And when you get a chance to have both simultaneously, that's where you want to be.
And he plans to keep working to make sure New York's transit system meets the needs of everyone in the city, regardless of their ability to see. For Making Contact, I'm Britta Conroy-Randall.
So we know New York City has the biggest subway system. But when you think of modern, green public transportation, a city that likely comes to mind is Portland, Oregon. Portland has built a reputation worldwide, and for many people, it's deserved. But as reporters Jennifer Kemp and Eric Klein found out, that world-class public transit doesn't serve all members of the public equally.
I took the bus all over town, talking to people about their commutes and asking what they thought about the transportation system.
I go everywhere on the bus.
Portland's public transit is amazing compared to what I had.
This is the best transportation system of all the different cities that I've been in.
I think it's a great bus, actually, and my son loves taking the bus.
The public transit in Philadelphia is some of the worst I've ever ridden, and Portland is great for public transit.
Portland's public transportation works well for people that live close to the center of town. They have a number of different buses and trains to choose from, wait times are pretty short, and the price of bus fare is definitely cheaper than paying for car payments, gasoline, and insurance. But the farther away from downtown people live, the less satisfied they are with the bus system, and the less they feel like they're getting their money's worth. Susie Thurston lives in Southeast, but works all the way out in North Portland. The number 75 bus is her lifeline, but she also has to transfer to the number 72.
When I go to work, it takes me an hour each way.
The buses she takes to work are very dependable. The problem comes when she tries to go from her neighborhood to her doctor's appointments across town. That bus line was cut in 2012.
There's really no buses now that I know of that go to Northwest, except for the 77, which doesn't even stop downtown and runs every half an hour.
The cuts came because the city's transit agency, TriMet, is running on a tight budget. Thurston says she understands the economic pressures, but the agency risks losing passengers.
If buses run too infrequently, then it's just not convenient for people to take them, you know?
Portland State University student Derek Espinoza lives in Hillsboro, a city southwest of Portland, where he says getting around by bus or light rail is a real challenge.
The buses are more expensive and they're cutting routes. It's not as much noticeable here in Portland, but in Hillsboro they've actually cut routes that I've used to take to get to places, so it's harder to get to where I need to go.
He also finds himself with extremely long waits, making it difficult to get anything done.
The wait for the bus that I need to take is about an hour. If I were to go anywhere I needed to go in Hillsboro. Now I'm more asking friends for rides or sometimes even taking a taxi over there in Hillsboro.
And not everyone has the option of asking friends for a ride. Cameron Johnson is what you call transit dependent. Because he's autistic, he makes frequent trips to the pharmacy. And Cameron lives in outer southeast Portland, where bus service is less reliable.
I actually am bipolar and autistic, so relying on the bus is something that both helps my mental wellness and helps me get medication that I need to maintain that. So technically I qualify for an Auto Citizens card because otherwise I wouldn't be able to afford the bus and I'd be homebound.
Johnson says relying on the bus has affected his job opportunities. He says a temp agency found him a job in Beaverton, a city west of Portland, but the bus he would need to take to get there started running at 6:30 a.m.
They wanted me to start at 6, so there'd be no way I could feasibly make it in time without leaving at 4 and getting there 20 minutes late.
Cameron isn't just a transit-dependent rider, though. He's also deeply involved in transit activism. He's an active member of the transit justice group OPAL, organizing people, activating leaders, volunteering to organize bus riders into a collective force to influence TriMet's policies.
We started working on behalf of making the service usable and feasible for transit-dependent people like myself. And I realized that a lot of what's going on isn't just unfair, it's a lot of BS going on in there.
TriMet uses fare increases and service cuts as a way to balance their budget, which has had persistent shortfalls since 2009 because of the faltering economy. Here's TriMet CEO Neil McFarlane speaking on Oregon Public Broadcasting in February 2012 about what he calls a budget crisis projected for his agency.
Over the last 4 years, we've actually reduced our budget trajectory by $60 million at TriMet. That was through the Great Recession. So we've had to make some reductions of both bus and MAX service over those last 4 years. And I think people are generally telling us enough is enough related to service cuts. But they did tell us that there is some tolerance for increasing fares. And so our recommendations rely more heavily on fare increases than they do on service reductions.
It's questionable whether those reductions were really needed. Con Pham was a communications director of Opal last year. A disclaimer, she also worked for this radio program before moving to Portland. Pham says TriMet was caught bluffing in 2012.
The budget crisis that they projected never materialized. They were basing it on projections that didn't turn out to be true. And those super conservative projections ended up having to be borne by the most vulnerable people who couldn't afford the fare cuts that turned out we didn't need.
And the 2014 budget, which came out in early March, shows that TriMet received $28 million more in revenue than they had predicted in 2012. Even though TriMet management told the public that they were in the middle of a three-year pay freeze, TriMet executives are receiving pay raises totaling almost $1 million. On the positive side, there won't be any new service cuts, but service will not be returned to pre-2012 levels. Last June, Opal had dozens of members testify in front of the TriMet board to demand it reject planned cuts to service.
That TriMet is seriously considering hiking fares and cutting services is going 180 degrees in the wrong direction.
I have a very limited budget. I cannot pay 1/8 of that budget for a monthly bus pass. So I personally am that individual who composes that little statistic about losing rides as fare increases.
Without affordable mobility, people can become trapped, isolated, and their success becomes threatened.
Jared Franz is a transportation policy assistant with Opal.
Not only do people have a hard time getting where they're going on a single ticket, especially people like single mothers who have to make a multiple stop. Maybe they're having to drop off a child at daycare before getting back on the bus to go to work. But TriMet has been cutting bus service for years. Since 2004, they've cut over 170,000 hours of bus service. And so it's getting harder and harder for people to make their connections.
Opal had proposed their own alternative budget to TriMet, which would leave bus service at 2012 levels. Although it was rejected, they're now working to retain a citywide program giving Portland Public School students free bus passes to get to and from class, which is in jeopardy of being cut. They're campaigning to get transfer times extended from 2 hours to 3, and they're trying to reinvest in outer Southeast Portland. Again, Opal activist and transit-dependent writer Cameron Johnson.
People need transit. People need to have reliable transit, and TriMet knows that they're a captive audience. They know that they can cut bus service and some people will be forced to stick around, and that's something I'm not ever okay with, and I'm not okay with people misunderstanding. I think transit-dependent people need a voice, and TriMet needs to recognize that, and everyone needs to recognize that.
For Making Contact with Eric Klein, I'm Jennifer Kemp in Portland, Oregon.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The trains of Greater Buenos Aires, Argentina are falling apart. Every weekday, their carriages are filled with commuters on their way to the city. Despite a regular service, it's still the fastest and cheapest way to get to work. But the cars are old, the rails are worn, and the wooden covers on the electric third rail are often rotten or missing entirely. So how did it get this way? Well, a group of train workers and student activists says the problem is that private companies have been put in charge of this public transit system and aren't giving it the attention it needs. The only solution, they say, would be to put the trains back under state control. And they're organizing to do just that. From Buenos Aires, Eilish O'Neill has more.
Every day, 3 million people from Greater Buenos Aires enter the city to go to work. Hundreds of thousands of them get there by train. In the south and west of the city, many of the people that ride the trains are poor or working class, and the trains they take are in terrible shape. For years, video game tester Laura Rodriguez rode one of those trains every day.
Until you have to take the train every day at rush hour, you don't really understand how horrible they are. When the train is full, it's so full that there are people in the doors and you can't get on. When you have to get to work on time, you have to push, and it's really violent. It's horrible. I've had my clothes ripped off me. Once, a little girl fell between the platform and the train. She fell there because people were pushing to get on. And the girl was crying, and the people just walked by. What occurred to me to do was to make a wall with my arms so that her mother could lift her out. And people swore at me.
In the 1990s, under neoliberal President Carlos Menem, Argentina underwent a wave of privatization. The government granted the operation of the trains of Greater Buenos Aires to private companies. The state still owns the rails and the cars. It controls the ticket prices and gives subsidies to the companies that operate the lines. But Edgardo Reynoso, a third-generation train worker and an organizer of the Sarmiento Line Train Workers Union, says those subsidies aren't always used to maintain the transit system.
Lejos de invertir en el sistema ferroviario.
Far from investing in the trains, the people that manage the trains deposited the public money in their personal accounts. We've done investigations in which we've found the CEOs of concessionary companies with deposits in tax havens.
The drain on public resources and the poor state of the trains went on unquestioned for years, until February of 2012. On the Sarmiento line in western Buenos Aires, a tragic accident brought attention to the disrepair. A train's brakes failed as it was coming into the station. Unlike newer cars, which slide on top of each other during accidents, the first two cars smashed together. 51 passengers were killed and hundreds more were wounded. Laura Rodriguez was on that train.
We tried to pick up the people that had fallen, but each one weighed a ton. We tried to organize ourselves so that the wounded could stay inside the train, so the medics could take care of them there. Then we walked along the platform to leave. And when we got to the first and second cars, they were jammed together. They didn't look like two cars. They looked like one car. And there was a lot of black blood. That shocked me. The blood was black, really dense.
After the accident, the government intervened in the Sarmiento line and now operates it in conjunction with two private transportation companies. For more than 6 months, there have been no trains at night or on Sundays and holidays so that workers can repair the tracks. Reynoso, who started organizing the workers of the Sarmiento line in the late 1990s, says his union has always asked for more maintenance of the trains and tracks, and that as a result of last year's accident, the government is finally listening.
Bueno, acá estamos en Once.
Here we are in the Once station. It's inconceivable to think that this site of so much traffic, we're talking about 350,000 people every day, was so dilapidated. There you can see the new rails in a pile. In this part, they still need to change the rails. If you look that way, you'll see the worn-out rails.
But not all passengers feel reassured by the repairs. After the accident, Laura Rodriguez started taking the bus to work, even though it cost five times as much as the train and took half an hour longer. Transportation planner Olga Vicente says the loss of train passengers is going to put the entire transportation system of Greater Buenos Aires in crisis.
There's been a notable loss of passengers in the train lines during the last 3 years. The passengers that left the trains now commute in personal cars, shuttle buses, and regular buses.
A group of train workers and student activists has come together to demand the renationalization of the trains. They say doing so would not only improve conditions for those who currently ride, but could also tempt former passengers back out of their cars and buses and onto the rails. Student activist Adrian Lutvak says that putting the trains under state control would create the possibility for central planning and greater transparency.
It's not that I have high expectations either for this government or for the state in general. What I believe is that when the state controls the trains, it's much easier to control and dispute decisions.
Lutvak isn't alone. Juan Carlos Sena was a train worker for 44 years and is now the president of the National Movement for the Recovery of Argentina's Trains. He says Argentina should look at Spain's overhaul of its trains, begun in the 1990s, for a model of how far a national railroad system can come in a short time.
When Spain had to change its railroads, all that infrastructure because it was entering the European common market, then Prime Minister Felipe González restructured all the railroads, changed the width of the rails, and made everything electric. He trained the employees. You can't imagine how hard the unions worked, how hard everyone worked. And today, the Spanish railway is making high-speed trains.
Sena says Spain's ability to overhaul its trains shows how the government has the resources, the planning capability, and the long-term and national-level vision required to overhaul a transportation system.
Only the state can manage big-scale technological development and the huge investments necessary for that technological development. Private companies only want profits, nothing else.
And the profits that the transportation companies of Greater Buenos Aires are reaping don't even come from ticket sales. They receive millions in government subsidies. Many passengers, especially those on the Sarmiento line, say they pay only occasionally or never.
No one pays nowadays after the accident. No one has ever paid. They stopped asking for the tickets.
This has to do with lowering passenger dissatisfaction. The way some people think is, well, if you don't pay, you don't have the right to complain, right? At least you commute for free.
But sociology professor Julian Rebon says a better way to lower passenger dissatisfaction is to improve service and prevent accidents. And he adds that the whole idea that the railroads could or should generate monetary profits is faulty.
The profits from a transportation system like the trains lie in their positive social effects. The trains make it so people can get to work. They cut down on pollution, they cut down on traffic, they reduce violence. They have a lot of positive effects.
A number of legislators agree that the trains are a necessary public good that should be renationalized, and they've written bills to that effect. One bill would nationalize not only the trains of Greater Buenos Aires, but the railroads of the entire country. The federal company created to run these trains would be directed by one representative from the executive, one from the provincial railroads, one from the workers, one from the passengers, and one from the cargo train users. Juan Carlos Sena of the National Movement for the Recovery of Argentina's Trains says right now there's not enough political will to renationalize the trains, but that eventually there will be. The train comes back, says Sena. It will come back as it did all over the world. For Making Contact, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks to the Ben & Jerry's Foundation for partial funding for this program. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.